I'm reporting on work that was mainly done here at Perimeter in collaboration with Astrid, with Alessandro Fontrini. He did his master's thesis here, and with Ilya Wilensky, he did an undergraduate project here. And if you're interested, the two examples that I will talk about mostly in this are these two papers. And the work with Ilya I will just use as a motivation. There's really not the main part of the talk. The main message that I want to confer in this talk is that the functional renormalization group equation that you might know, or that I expect most of you to know, from the asymptotic safety program in quantum gravity, so what Martin Reuter and his collaborators, also Astrid here, use, is also a useful tool in matrix models and tensor models. And to show how it's useful and how it is used, I give you two examples about where I use purely the functional renormalization group to confirm asymptotic safety. That in models where it has previously been established with other methods, in particular in the constructive program, but where I only use those methods that are actually used to investigate quantum gravity in the asymptotic safety program. So, my plan for this talk is to give a little bit, talk a little bit about the functional renormalization group, then go over those two models where asymptotic safety has been known and explain to you how you recover it with the functional renormalization group. And I hope at the end I have a little bit time to talk about what the general recipe is. Because as it turns out, you don't have to change your strategy very much from continuum field theory if you go to those discrete matrix models. There is one point that is non-trivial, and I will talk about that. So the main idea behind the functional renormalization group equation is that you introduce a scale into your system. So you have a quantum field theory, and you define it through your path integral. But the path integral itself is usually ill-defined. And that was basically the starting point for Wilson, was to view the regulator, to view the V cutoff, or to view an extrinsic scale as an integral part of the definition of a quantum field theory, and then to study how the path integral changes as you change the regulator scale. This is not exactly the Wilsonian way. You assume already that you have a path integral, and in the functional renormalization group equation, you introduce a scale, and it will be called K. Later in matrix models, this scale K will become the matrix size, and then it will be called N, and you implement a regulator, now an infrared suppression term, in the path integral. So you suppress IR degrees of freedom. These are those degrees of freedom that are in the infrared of this scale K here, by giving them a mass term of order k squared. So in the Euclidean path integral, they will be suppressed with an e to the minus k squared, all those infrared degrees of freedom. So they will essentially decouple and and can be and are essentially negligible for the evaluation of the path integral. And then, but then you can look at, so this gives you an effective action with this cutoff implemented of your field. So so this is the generator for the one particle irreducible Green's functions. And this K here indicates that you have calculated that with this particular cutoff implemented, with this particular infrared suppression already implemented. And then you can study what happens if, how does gamma K change if I go from K to K plus delta K? So I have a gamma K plus a small deviation of K. And that is very much, this is where the analogy with the original Wilsonian picture is, that you study this change of the effective action. And that can be visualized. What I have in mind can be visualized when you look how this functional changes. So the idea is that you have, that someone gives you an initial condition, an initial ansatz for the effective action from somewhere. And this is in a theory space, so each point in this space represents a whole functional of your field. So it's a whole effective action. And the axis here, I wrote G's with numbers on them. That's just a coordinate system, which you would call these coordinates coupling constants, usually. But the equation is really a functional equation, and I will not use details of the equation throughout this talk. I will give you the picture. I will focus on the big picture. But the equation that tells you how the effective action changes as you change your cutoff or your infrared suppression term is this. This is an operator trace, and I show you which operator it is. It's k dk of rk, where rk is the function, is the mass function as a function of a Laplacian that you choose for the field. So the Laplacian determines what is infrared and what is UV, and this is the mass function for these as a function of the Laplacian. Let's write it like that. In the simplest case, it's the Laplacian. You can do more complicated things. And then you take the full propagator, so the full second variation of the effective action, and you don't just take, so it looks almost like like the Coleman-Weinberg potential, you can actually write it like that if you write it as, if you remember that that is the one loop determinant. If you write it as dt of trace log of 2 plus r, but now you have to s equals k. So you see that it's really a one loop structure that you have. If you were to replace this gamma here with a bare action, then you would have the one loop determinant here. And this is really just writing the scale derivative as you act on that. And this gives obviously that. So the reason this is a useful and non-perturbative tool is that it has several aspects. So one is what I just said. You can make a piecemeal approach to performing the path integral. Somebody gives you the initial condition. If you're interested in the in evaluating the approximate path integral, then you can in principle use this equation to evolve the initial condition down here to the infrared and find the effective action. So it's a piecemeal approach. To the path integral. Another point is that you see immediately you have with this picture that I drew here, which I will explain a little more, you have access to the low energy effective behavior. Already in very small truncations, you find, so a truncation is an ansatz for the effective action that neglects most of the couplings. In particular, finite dimension ansatz. You have sometimes, you very often gain a very good idea what the infrared physics looks like, even if you don't have access to the full path integral or to the full non-perturbative theory. But what is mainly used for in the asymptotic safety program is doing precisely the opposite. It's looking for those theories, those infrared theories, that can be completed all the way in the UV. And a particular way of doing this is if you have a fixed point of linearization group. So if the right-hand side here vanishes, in a particular way that I will explain in a moment, that the dimensionless, that it vanishes for the dimensionless couplings, then you can complete the path integral, because now you have a complete, you can look at this as a complete theory. The question is not to go from the UV to the infrared, like I described so far, but to go the other way around, to look which effective field theories do actually admit a UV completion. So you probably don't have, so you don't have to change your degrees of freedom to take the continuum limit. So this gives you access to possible bare actions that you can put into the path integral for which a continuum limit exists. And so this is the asymptotic. So this is a systematic tool, and the scenario that I described, find a fixed point and look around this fixed point, linearize the flow around this fixed point, and see which effective actions evolve into the fixed point as you go into the UV. That is the asymptotic safety scenario. In particular, if this critical surface, so the surface in which the space of effective actions that evolves back into this fixed point into the UV is finite dimensional, then you have a predictive theory, because you just have to make a finite number of measurements. Then you fixed all the coupling constants in there, and you can make predictions. Every calculation after that gives predictions. So this is safety, and this is, in particular, if you have a non-Gaussian fixed point, as I indicated here. So here at the origin, you will have the Gaussian fixed point where all coupling constants vanish. And this will be important for the Grosse-Wolkenhorn model, because the asymptotic safety is confirmed in the vicinity of the Gaussian fixed point. And another point is that if you have several fixed points, then you have different critical surfaces like this associated with it. And now what I indicated in this picture here is it doesn't really matter where you start out with your initial condition. If you evolve the renormalization group, if you start out with a generic initial condition, it will the and you have some scale separation, so you evolve over several scales, then the critical surface with the closest, in quotation mark, fixed point will attract the effective action. So that is an infrared attractive direction, and then it will just follow the flow, and you will not be able to distinguish after a long scale separation in the infrared, you will not be able to distinguish this initial condition from the gamma star initial condition. Because if I'm here, as I indicated here, they will be exponentially close to each other. And so this gives you access to different phases, because no matter where I start out here in the infrared, I will end up here. And if I know the effective action in this regime here has a particular behavior, is something that I know, then I can distinguish this phase from a phase that would, for example, come out of the Gaussian fixed point, where I would have a different sort of infrared theory. Or for example, a free field theory would go back into the Gaussian fixed point. You can have a mass term, but a mass term would go away in the UV, so you would just have a one-dimensional critical surface, or more than one-dimensional, like in QCD, where you have asymptotic freedom, you have also the QCD coupling. But then you could have a different phase here if you have a different fixed point. So what I want to say with this is that it's a tool to distinguish. So searching for fixed points and these critical surfaces is a tool to get information about the phase diagram. There is, of course, I skipped over a lot of what you have to do to reliably identify a phase diagram, but I just wanted to say that. And that's why I cited some unpublished work with Ilya Wilensky, because on the fuzzy sphere and fuzzy torus, we did some explicit calculations using the same methods that I use today. And it's really in very small truncations you see the characteristic behavior of several phases that are known from Monte Carlo simulations in how the renormalization group trajectory is bent in this truncated theory space. Let me go to the examples that I wanted to talk about. Yes?
Can you say how this interacts with gauge invariance? It seems like a scary thing to do. So.
Yes, it is a scary thing to do. And I will comment on that, hopefully, at the end when I talk about the recipe for a little bit. But what you get is, if you write, this is derived by putting a mass term into the path integral, which destroys the naive gauge invariance. So you don't have the ordinary void identity that you associate, so for example in QED. But you still have an identity there, which is you have the expectation value of the regulator, of the gauge transformation of the regulator. And the vacuum expectation value of that is then the right-hand side of your void identity. So in principle, you have it there, but in practice, that's an unmanageable equation. So in practice, this is This is mostly used for numerical evolution. You can actually use that, because there you can calculate what that is numerically, and you can find. But to do analytic results, if the symmetry is not linearized, you know that you can't. It becomes hopeless to actually work with those border linearities. That was actually my first contact with the functional normalization group equation, was thinking, why has nobody ever used the border linearities? Because in the asymptotic safety program, in the original publication by Reuter, there is a section called void identities, and he couples it to anti-fields and like all the things that you would do, and derives them, but then they were not used after that. And I asked people why, and I got evasive answers, and then I tried to use them, and I soon discovered why they were not used, because you couldn't. Because you couldn't actually. So the first model that I announced is the Grosse-Wolkenhorn model, and that's a non-commutative scalar field theory. And it's a Euclidean four-dimensional non-commutative theory, so you could write the action in a position space representation on R4, SD4X, then you have d mu phi, a star product, which is just two copies of the Majorana product. So you have two copies of the Majorana plane. D mu phi plus, and this is what is important for this model to work, and I will explain in a second why. So this action you would immediately recognize as, if I would not have this term here, you would immediately recognize it as a scalar field theory where I just replaced all the dot products, all the pointwise products with Majorana products. And so you would say, okay, that's probably the non-commutative analog of a five-fourth theory, right? That action. But what turns out is that If you do a one-loop calculation, for example, with this ansatz where this term is not there, then you will get a divergence proportional to that term. So this position-dependent term here, and this is just a rescaling with the theta mu nu, the Majorana constant theta tensor. This is what this is, this x mu. So this term, if you want to define your theory, this term has to be included from the beginning. But then it turns out, and that is that was discovered by Langmann and Chabot, that an action of that form has a symmetry, and this is that an action with this coupling constant omega, m and lambda, is invariant under, if you do the following transformation, you take omega squared s 1 over omega m over omega lambda over omega squared, and you see the pattern here. You see it here. The volume element here is basically gives you this omega squared term here. The m's, and each field gets a 1 over omega except for the kinetic term. because there is an omega associated with these that comes from the from that. What I want to say is there is a hidden symmetry in there, a hidden discrete symmetry. So going from omega to 1 over omega. This symmetry going from omega to 1 omega singles out the point omega equals 1. And now if I write little omega as omega squared minus 1, then I can rewrite that this action here as a matrix model action. And to do that, I have to first get the dimensionality out of the volume element. So I get a 2 pi theta, where theta is the non-commutative scale, squared, which has the, it's a four-dimensional, and the non-commutative scale is usually of an area. So that's where that comes from. And then you have a trace, and you have a 1 plus omega half over 2 phi x x phi, where this is x mu, plus an omega half phi x mu, plus the mass term phi phi, plus in lambda over 24 phi 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 phi. So, which means that you can, what the magic is, by just expanding these fields in terms of a basis, so phi of x is the sum over m1, m2, n1, n2, some expansion coefficients, phi m n f mn of x, but this is really related to the harmonic oscillator, as you would expect. Those are the Hermite polynomials in two dimensions. If you do that, then you can, if you do this expansion, then you map the Moyal product into the matrix product for this, for these expansion coefficients. And that's how you turn this thing where it's hard to calculate anything non-perturbatively in this non-commutative scale theta in something that is very manageable, a matrix model, where you can derive everything to all orders in theta because you know how to calculate the matrix product.
So what is capital X?
Pardon me?
Capital X.
Oh, this capital X here is this X here. So it's really the coordinate X. So it has, so it's a scalar field theory, but the UV IR mixing of non-commutative scalar field theory gives you, requires that you have to have a position dependent.
Yeah, no, I understand that in the second law, you could take just the trace.
So it's the same, it's the matrix representation of this X here. So it's a constant fixed external matrix, and you know that in
expanded into the spaces.
If I were to use phi of x is equal x mu, then I would get the matrix representation by doing that to x. So now people, there was a lot of work.
Tim?
Yes.
So. Where does the decomposition of phi of x as a matrix comes from? So is it just like, maybe you said it, I just missed it. So well, why do you decompose that as a matrix, or why?
The reason why you do that is, if there have been calculated these Moyal planes and Moyal products, they have a long, they have since the famous Seiberg-Witten paper, they have a history in particle physics. What people have been doing in particle physics was they expanded this Moyal product in terms of a commutative product plus order theta corrections, and then they put that in perturbatively. There is the problem with doing that because you don't see all the non-perturbative effects of this non-commutative scale theta if you do that, if you just expand in theta. But if you map it into a matrix product and you, if you do the expansion in terms of these eigenfunctions of this x operator here, of this xx operator, which turn out to be these fms that give you these expansion coefficients, then you find this matrix product contains the Moyal product to all orders, so it's the exact Moyal product. So I do not truncate in any order of theta, but I have a product that is manageable because I don't know if you write it like x d mu to the left theta mu nu d nu to the right, that is your matrix product, then what do you do with that in this formulation? That's hard. But in this formulation, it's just a matrix product when you do that expansion. That's why. So does that answer your question?
No. So I was wondering where this decomposition comes from. I mean,
the decomposition comes actually from what you know from the Moyal product.
It's just take
Hermite polynomials to diagonalize the Laplacian, the Moyal Laplacian, and expand in terms of those eigenfunctions. That's the which one is that? So the message from the constructive program was, and that was Raswan was involved in that, Vinsaw, I forgot the other two names in the original publication, but they said for small enough lambda, this model is asymptotically safe. And for the language that is useful for the FRG is, that means if I have lambda small enough, then I can find a region around the Gaussian fixed point, and if I call this coupling constant now here, this lambda dimensionless, if I make this region here small enough, then the flow in lambda will be confined to that region. So if I start out in that region, I can never leave it. I can bound the flow to always stay inside. And this is what we wanted to confirm with the FRG. And so what do you have to do? Well, I told you you have to start out with a theory space. So now if you look at this here, and now I told you there's a special symmetry when this omega here is 1. So if you go to the symmetric point, which is UV attractive, you can do this calculation. It's really simple to confirm UV attractivity of omega equal, of little omega equals 0 or capital omega equal 1. If you do that, then you have a theory space in which you have traces, you have phis, and you have this operator xx in it, which is just a constant matrix. So your ansatz for the effective action looks something like this. You have a sum over stuff that looks like a coupling constant, and then you have a phi to the A some xx, and more stuff, phis and x's. Then you have many more of those, and it ends at bxx and more. And then you have some coupling constant g that has some label here, alpha, that encodes what the index structure here is. So what the phis and x's and so on are. So one thing that is important is that this, that each trace acts like a volume integral. So it has a dimension of this 2 pi theta squared. And each x is an area. So you get, so these have, these operators have a dimension that is theta to the minus 2 times the number of these x-axis minus, and then you have the number of traces minus 1, and then minus 4 times the number of traces minus the number of traces minus 1.
I think that's a possibility.
Okay, so the number of x-axis minus 2 times the number of 2 times the number of traces minus 1. That's the dimension that these operators always have. And it's this dimensionality that allows us to do some bounds. Because how can we go about this to confirm that the flow is actually bounded? So one thing that you might worry about is the Landau pole in scalar phi force theory. You see, you would expect that you have the lambda dot is proportional to lambda squared, and then for positive lambda you run into in finite time you have an infinite amount of lambda. You can do a simple calculation in the truncation that is just given by this original Grosse-Wulkner action. And by the same effect that, by the same UVIR mixing effect that generated this omega term there, you get an extra wave function renormalization at one loop in this theory.
So you make the renormalization with respect to the matrix?
With respect to matrix size, but this is also a UV cutoff for this theory. It's a UV and IR cutoff because of this of the symmetric way in which I chose that. So you take UV and IR simultaneously in that model.
Okay, so it's not just the momentum or something.
No, it's not just the momentum.
It's the eigenvalue of the Moyal Laplacian.
It's the eigenvalue of the Moyal Laplacian. It would be, if you were to put it in a box and to have an IR cutoff, it is effectively a UV cutoff in the position representation. But if you work on it, but if you want to translate that into the position representation, it's a UV and IR cutoff simultaneously. And you see that in this XX term, in this position-dependent term, when you cut off the kinetic term, which consists of these two summons, with capital omega equal to 1, then you see that gets a momentum contribution and a position contribution. So this extra wave function renormalization then turns out to completely cancel the renormalization of lambda at one loop. So you have dt of lambda vanishing due to this due to this effect, that you have a wave function normalization that you would not have in commutative scalar field theory. So that already gives you hope that you might have, which one is this? That you can be at this Gaussian fixed point here, and you might have an exactly marginal direction here. So a direction in which the beta function does not just vanish to first or second order, but which it vanishes to all orders. And that's actually not what we confirmed. Confirmed a slightly weaker statement, but that suffices to establish establish asymptotic safety, because now you do a full, so you, now you look at a truncation with all operators that renormalize with all operators up to phi to the 6, so up to 6 phis. Those are all operators that can directly influence the running of the original truncation, in particular of lambda. And then you get very messy beta functions, and you can write it out, but we didn't even write them out in the paper because they were pages long. But you can find estimates, you can find bounds on them. So now I have done this in a truncation. Now I need to put what I need to do is I have neglected operators like from order phi to the 8 onward, and that's the third step, is to estimate the effect of operators phi to the 8 and so and higher. And that can only be done because we are close to the Gaussian fixed point. Because at the Gaussian fixed point, the flow will be dominated by the mass dimension. And then if you're close enough to the Gaussian fixed point, and if the flow, and if the beta functions are continuous at least, then you can find a region epsilon that is just small enough such that the region delta is just small enough such that this is bounded by epsilon. So you get a g of t that is a g hat of t, so the dimension is g of t, that is bounded by some initial value kappa n, but then really e to the minus the dimension of, should give this an n, then a minus. So this epsilon half is the effect of all the other operators, of these operators that I have neglected onto those operators into n times t, where t is the log of k over lambda, so the infinite scale, essentially. And now this estimate you can only make in the vicinity of the Gaussian fixed point. And then you can insert that estimate into the beta function that you found for lambda and eta in this truncation. And then you put that together and you find dt of lambda hat is smaller than, as a function of t, is smaller than e to the minus 2t plus some epsilon times t. And then you have some constants, c naught plus c1 lambda hat plus c2 lambda hat squared. And now what you have to do is you have to show that when lambda is small enough, this flow also does not leave this region for lambda small enough. into that. You just have to study this differential equation by saturating that bound. And that's the, and that's how you confirm this asymptotic safety result, that once once lambda is small enough and once the trajectory has entered that region, you can estimate the effect of those operators that you have neglected in your calculation by just a small number here, then you're confined to that region and you can never leave it again. So that is the argument, and that's how, but as you see, the reason why it works in all of theory space is because we know how the operators scale at the Gaussian fixed point. That does not work at an interacting fixed point. And at an interacting fixed point, you would first have to calculate all of the beta all of the critical exponents before you could do that. And then if you could calculate all critical exponents at that interacting fixed point, then you would be in the same position. You could probably play a similar game. But this in-between step is the one that is really hard and practically unfeasible.
So when you go up to 5 to the 8, do you know 5 to the 10, 5 to the 12?
So this is really not what we did. We just estimated, we just said once you are in the region here in these extra large extra dimensions, once you are in the region that you can estimate their effect on the beta function, and you can do that by a small number, by this epsilon, then you can insert that effect back into the beta functions that you already calculated, and then you bound it into that. So it's a self-consistent thing. So if it could break, it is not a straightforward way to prove it. So in particular, we don't know the critical value of lambda where asymptotic safety breaks down. We just know if under the assumption that there is a Banach space on which the flow is differentiable, on which this is really a differentiable flow, you find a region around the Gaussian fixed point where you have an exactly marginal region around the Gaussian fixed point. But it's not even clear because the flow is only diffeomorphic to this linearized flow. So it will get contributions. So the fixed point is the line of fixed points that you would expect there in this asymptotic safety scenario can be bent. It just has to be the differential geometry would just ensure that it's diffeomorphic to a line segment, to a small line segment. Yes.
Do these results, in particular the point 3, assume some known results about the renormalizability of the theory?
They make one assumption. One assumption that I didn't state is that they assume that the beta functions are continuous near the Gaussian fixed point. So you can really do this epsilon delta reasoning that I was talking about. Otherwise it doesn't work. But all of that is in the assumption that the flow equation itself is continuous in some reasonable topology on this theory space, which we have not topologized theory space, and we have not checked whether it's differentiable.
So another way to ask the question is that because it seems that it implies, those results imply that the theory is normalizable, right?
I don't quite understand it.
So, the original paper by Grosse and Vulcana,
yes.
Work hard to prove that the theory is perturbatively renormalizable.
Yes, and it's the amount of work that you have to put in. I just sketched you what I do. If you go to the original Grosse-Vulcana proof, basically you look at what they do is they look how many initial conditions do you need for Podzinski's equation at the end, how many independent, and that's how they establish perturbative renormalizability. So this picture that I drew here is about as much as what I was saying as I would summarize, if I would summarize the original Grosse-Wulkinger paper in those words. So there is a lot of work in each of these steps that I didn't go over in detail.
But would you say that this is a non-perturbative result? Not really, because you're near your...
So there are two things where it's... I mean, what you call really non-perturbative and what not is your flavor. But there are two points that smell perturbative. That is, you need close vicinity to the Gaussian fixed point, so you can do these estimates. And what I also didn't say is, if you want to have if you want to be able to use these truncations reliably, then you need to rely on a vertex expansion near the Gaussian fixed point. Otherwise, you could not do that. And these two ingredients are very much perturbative.
Yeah.
So in that sense, yes. In that sense, it's just the tool that is used in quantum gravity applied to a non-trivial example of asymptotic safety, and seeing how does it really play out. If you want to find the asymptotic safety that people have used with shown with other methods, how does it play out with the tool that is used in the asymptotic safety program in gravity? That's what it's an example for. There is, of course, you can always say, because you have a rational approximation to the beta function rather than a polynomial, that is a non-perturbative effect. That is definitely in there, which is not in usual perturbation theory, because there you have a necessarily polynomial in the coupling constant. So I wanted, I'm running out of time, but I definitely wanted to give you, and I think it was useful to go over that example in more detail. In this recent work with Astrid, the second paper that I cited, we looked at the double scaling limit, which is in a matrix model for a two-dimensional Euclidean quantum gravity. And I won't have time to motivate that model now. But there, the picture is that you're really looking for, there the how can I say it without having to introduce the entire program? It's essentially the idea that you use a Lyapunov expansion for tessellating a Riemann surface and doing the quantum gravity path integral in that way. And there is, in this sense, there is a non-Gaussian fixed point in this matrix representation. And the known analytical results about the fixed point values and the critical exponents there. And what we did was we used a very similar model. Instead of a triangulation, we used the tessellation by squares of the Riemann surface, which is we used a Baer action that is of this form. And the reason why you would do that anyways is because if you have this has an additional Z2 symmetry under phi goes to minus phi. And that restricts the theory space and makes calculations quite a bit Yes, it does make calculations easier because you have much less coupling constants. And we calculated, and so there are analytic results about a non-Gaussian fixed point with, not like I drew it here, with a critical surface, but with a one-dimensional critical surface, so a critical line here around the gamma star. And we looked at truncations. So at the first kind of truncation that we looked at was to make, it was a single trace truncation. So we looked at something like a kinetic term phi squared plus an arbitrary potential. So this is we take all single trace operators, and it turns out you can find the beta functions. You can find a closed expression for the beta function of that system, and then we studied the fixed points of that system, and there is a fixed point that has all the flavor of what was established in matrix models in the 70s and early 80s. And the critical exponents get reasonably close. We get within about 20% of the analytic values for those critical exponents in that truncation. And then what we did, we enlarged the truncation to also include two double trace operators, and we found some improvement over, it's a marginal improvement over the, we found an improvement of, depending on how you normalize it, it's a 1 or 2% improvement over perturbation theory. But it could be, these whole things, these beta functions, we wrote them in an arbitrary scheme, and we evaluated the fixed point and the critical exponents in a particular scheme. It could be that just by optimizing the scheme, we can get even better results. Just by using exactly the same functions, and just you know, the scheme dependence appears as a set of numbers that are all of order one in there.
So like this choice of RK.
It's exactly the choice of RK. That you can write it independent of, you can write the beta functions are basically of a trace of RK and the propagator, the field independent part of the propagator to the ends. In terms of those numbers, you can write, this is where all this scheme dependence comes in.
So can you translate this truncation into which gluings are allowed? Or?
So in this, it's not like that you have gluings that are allowed. If you would start out with this action here.
Yeah, so
then you would say, oh, I have a propagator that looks like this.
Mm-hmm.
I have an interaction that looks like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I have my dual tessellation by squares that looks like that. Mm-hmm. And then really anything that goes, that respects these adjacency relations that are given by those points. All those are allowed.
Yeah. So what are the higher potential terms?
The higher order terms, they are effective operators that come by, how can I generate?
All what contributes to the 4-point function.
Okay.
So if I do something like this, and if I now forget the interior of here, that's an effective thing,
mm-hmm.
and that has a phi to the 6 now.
Okay. Yeah, okay. And the double trace is not that you introduce.
No, the double trace operators, you see from the structure of the flow equation that you need that they have an influence, that they contribute in the large n limit.
So So double trace just means product of two traces.
So what turns out by a simple scaling argument, what turns out is that you only need that if you have a truncation like this, the only, this is your single trace truncation, then the only double trace operators that can renormalize any couplings in there are those that come with a trace phi squared and then any one up in here. And the same is true for the next order. So if I look at triple trace operators, again, the only that can renormalize directly the double trace operators is the one that has trace phi squared times anything that I have in my double trace. But now in this double trace thing here, if I want to do a consistent expansion, I have to go to phi to the fourth here because if I allow their renormalization into those, then I have to also, to be consistent, take the trace phi to the four into these because they can also contribute.
But these are really connected to other topologies.
Yes, they're disconnected components in that picture.
So they're important for these double scaling limits.
They change the numerical values. And you can see that they do a considerable change to the numerical values. So I think I talked for an hour and I did not go over that this last work in detail, but one of the points that we wanted to make with that is that the functional renormalization group is a useful tool to investigate these models and also to investigate tensor models. And we concluded the paper with giving basically a recipe how you do these calculations. And there's one point that you already knew if you came from the program that constructs quantum gravity models with matrices or tensors. And that is that it's crucial to find the correct scaling of these operators with n, with your matrix size n. Because for almost every scaling, you cannot take a large n limit. The beta functions will not close in the large n limit. You will get something that diverges with n. So that you get something that is of order 1 plus order 1 beta function plus contributions that are suppressed by 1 over n or 1 over n squared and so on, you need very special scalings for all these operators. And that is the non-trivial part in that recipe. The other is really a straightforward translation of what you do in continuum field theory to that. And basically, it's traced back to the fact that these models do not have an inherent notion of a Laplacian. Instead, the Laplacian, and now I come back to your question, the Laplacian is replaced by this. The kinetic term is replaced by that, which has a UN symmetry. Because if I send phi to nu star by u, and that is invariant, and also all the other ingredients in that action. So that is a problem because that says I cannot have any slicing. I cannot do this piecemeal pass integral because I can do a polar decomposition of this matrix phi. So I have eigenvalues and two unitary matrices, or in the case of a Hermitian matrix model, a unitary matrix. But then it says that the only allowed Laplacian is the one that treats all eigenvalues the same. So you cannot do this step-by-step integration. And so there is a voided entity that associated with that. Symmetry that is broken by the regulator. And my conjecture is that you get better results for the critical exponents the more adapted you choose your regulator to this unitary symmetry. But of course, you cannot do it completely. But we haven't confirmed that. But it's a reasonable thing to assume.
So for usual quantum field theory, you would say it's reasonable to start with a scale given by momentum, because you would also kind of assume that there's only a weak coupling between different moments.
Yes, but I mean, you know, the argument against that is that you do a gauge transformation and the momentum slices are completely mixed up.
Uh-huh. No, but this has something similar for the scale.
So in that sense, there is something similar because you can look at the equations of motion for matrices that have just a small, that are just occupied in a small upper left block
uh-huh.
of the matrix.
So and so the couple only.
Yeah, so if this is something like this, if phi looks and I have zeros here
mm-hmm.
in a larger matrix, then the equations of motion for those matrices, they are just determined by this block.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a similar argument.
Mm-hmm.
For that, because all the matrix products and traces just depend on that. But nevertheless, it's so in fact, that's how we identify coupling constants by using these small matrices.
So is there a similar organization of the couplings here? You can organize a derivative, like make a derivative expansion.
So there is, it's not the derivative expansion, it's really an expansion in terms of the mass dimension or in terms of the scaling dimension
okay.
that you use there. And that is reasonable in the same, I mean, it might not be reasonable if you're far away from the Gaussian fixation, but if you have like this double scaling limit is very close to the Gaussian fixed point, but yet interacting. So it's, and if we actually look at the critical exponents that we calculate, we find that they go like the mass dimension plus a really small deviation,
mm-hmm.
except for the one that is relevant. That has a larger deviation from the mass dimension, but all the others go almost exactly like the mass dimension. This is what it's saying.
Okay, so maybe this one we should paint it.